The Prison Radio Show is a twice-monthly news show on CKUT. The show seeks to confront the invisibility of prisons and prisoner struggles by focusing on the roots of incarceration, policing, and criminalization, and by challenging ideas about what prisons are and who ends up inside. We have been running a phone line for prisoners and their outside supporters for the last couple years, and the phone number has recently changed. You can now reach us at 438-858-6116. We would like to thank Fed Phone Line for providing us with this number for free. They wanted us to tell you that they help save money to inmates' family and friends by reducing the cost of collect calls. For more information about their company, you can go to fedphoneline.com. So again, our new number is 438-858-6116. You can call us collect from Bordeaux Prison and Riviera de Prairie Prison at that number. As always, we're an all-volunteer collective and don't always manage to answer the phone. If you can leave a message, please do. If you are calling collect and we don't pick up, try again next time you can get to the phone. And again, our phone number is 438-858-6116, and you can call us collect from Riviera de Prairie Prison or Bordeaux Prison.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The Intercept is reporting. The New York Times has instructed its reporters to avoid using the terms genocide, ethnic cleansing, and occupied territory in its coverage of Israel's war on Gaza. The Intercept's report is based on an internal memo from The Times. One newsroom source told The Intercept, quote, "I think it's the kind of thing that looks professional and logical if you have no knowledge of the historical context of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. But if you do know, it'll be clear how apologetic it is to Israel," they said. Today, we're joined by a Palestinian journalist who's been highly critical of how the Western media has portrayed Israel's war in Gaza. Dalia Hatouka is an independent Palestinian journalist specializing in Israeli-Palestinian affairs, usually based between Amman, Jordan, and Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. She was a close friend and colleague of the Al Jazeera reporter Shireen Abu Akla, who was shot dead by an Israeli sniper in the occupied West Bank May 11th, 2022. Dalia's latest piece for the Century Foundation is headlined, "Undercover of Gaza War, Assault on West Bank Accelerates." Dalia joins us now in our New York studio after speaking last night at the Columbia Journalism School. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. This was also the topic of your panel at the Columbia J School last night, the issue of how the conflict is being covered. What do you think is most important for people to understand, Dalia?
Well, I think that a lot of what's missing from the bigger portrait or the puzzle, so to speak, is the Palestinian voice. So in order to find out what's going on in Gaza, we need to not just rely on Western journalists coming into Gaza. I know that's very important, and it's a demand by a lot of us and by, you know, the Committee to Protect Journalists and other journalism rights groups. But it's also to amplify Palestinian voices, because ultimately nobody knows Gaza better than the Gazan journalists on the ground who are actually doing the work that they're doing right now. And in a way, these journalists, not only are they fighting for their lives while doing all of this, they're also resorting to extraordinary measures to be able to cover what's going on. And speaking to journalists on the ground, they tell us that what we're seeing from them is only like 10% of what's happening in Gaza at the moment.
And, Dalia, I wanted to ask you, the Western press does have the opportunity to cover what is going on in the West Bank. And yet this, as you wrote in a recent piece, more than 4,000 West Bank Palestinians have been displaced just in 2023, the highest number ever recorded. What is going on in the West Bank from what you've been able to see?
Basically, in the West Bank, the fog of war has allowed Israel to perpetuate crimes at a very large scale, not only throughout the West Bank, but including occupied East Jerusalem. And in the West Bank, we've got what a lot of even Israeli officials have admitted are pogroms that are going on by and being perpetrated by Israeli settlers, especially in villages around Nablus, for example, which are in the north, where there are many settlements surrounding villages. We're not talking about just, you know, the torching of houses and the torching of cars and whatnot. We're talking about people getting killed by armed settlers. And while they're being armed and attacking Palestinians, they're also being helped or aided by Israeli soldiers whose job technically is to be there to not allow such things to happen. But in a way, you know, sometimes they just sit by idly and not do anything, or they actually participate in these attacks. That's why when you look at the UN figures, a lot of the times we see, you know, 10 Palestinians have been killed by settlers, 2 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces. But then there is a line that says 3 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli settlers and or soldiers. So we don't know, because they are part of the system that's subjugating these Palestinians, that's, you know, carrying out all this violence against them.
And it's not just those who are killed, but also the detentions of Palestinians in the West Bank. Could you talk about the conditions that they're facing in Israeli custody?
The detentions, honestly, they're atrocious, and they are the least talked about, even among Western journalists who actually haven't been really mentioning this at all. We're talking about the least amount of you know, livable situations that can be, that any detainee can live in. So they get water up to 2 hours a day now. Sometimes they don't get to shower. The food that they get is rotten. I'm talking about the detainees in the 9,000 or so in Israeli prisons. They don't have access to their families. They don't have access to lawyers. The people who have come out with some have had their limbs amputated because of the extended use of handcuffs. So honestly, the conditions are really harrowing, and there's not much access. And right now, as we speak, I was just seeing that there is a detainee who died in actually in an Israeli hospital a few days ago, and his body is still being withheld, and his family has not been able to put him to rest. Because even though he had already carried out his sentence, 30 or more years, which is quite frankly a devastating thing for the family, because they're unable to get any kind of closure.
You're talking, of course, about Waleed Dakka. His human rights groups, everyone had asked for him to be released, as he was there for almost 40 years and he was dying of cancer. Speaking of people who have died, not in prison, but outside, the last time I spoke to you was just after Shireen Abu Akleh was killed, May 11, 2022, as she was a dear friend of yours, the Al Jazeera Arabic reporter outside the Jenin refugee camp, all laid out now, determined to be an Israeli sniper who killed her. As her colleagues tried to reach her, they shot at them, clearly wearing press. It wasn't in the middle of any kind of skirmish. They were just standing outside. This issue of journalists being killed that you spoke of before, the memorial for Shireen outside Jenin has now been bulldozed over, destroyed by the Israeli military. But even in Gaza—and you you took this up last night, you and your colleagues on the panel, of what's happening to journalists. Even you were surprised, you said, as we spoke before the show, by learning about when David Remnick, the editor of The New Yorker, asked, how do you know that journalists are targeted? Talk about the response.
Basically, we were very lucky to have a journalist from Gaza who managed to leave the coastal enclave, the besieged coastal enclave, to Qatar. Her name is Amira Harouda. And she had to leave, obviously, because, you know, for her well-being and her family, she has four kids. Anyways, she was talking about the fact that journalists would get phone calls from Israeli authorities, military authorities, basically questioning them about their work, especially if they worked for Qatar, which is a little strange, considering that Qatar is the go-between, you know, between Israel and Hamas for the talks to reach a ceasefire and to release the hostages. So, in the meantime, also CPJ, was talking to a few journalists who were released after being detained, and they had been taken away for 33 days, made to sit in squatting positions in horrific conditions. They came out, you know, having lost 30 kilos or so. There's a lot going on in that sense, but also the targeting of journalists. People know because there are UAVs or drones, as we say, constantly hovering in Gaza. It's so perpetual that people in Gaza, if they don't hear a UAV, they think something's wrong. UAVs have been part of the Gaza skyline for years, long before October 7th.
And even the phone calls from the Israeli military to journalists threatening them?
Yes, absolutely. And in the West Bank, they do the same thing. They call them in, they say, we want to have a chat with you, and then they don't come out because, you know, they take them in, they can put them in administrative detention, which, as you know, is basically when you put people in or Palestinians in prison without any kind of proof or without charging them, and it's very easy to do that. I mean, right now there's a young Christian girl who's a student. She's in administrative detention for 4 months, and I know that the Archbishop of Canterbury was calling for her release. So all these things are intertwined. There's a lot of things going on that are far-reaching. It's not just about journalists.
And the journalists who are being detained in Gaza are being questioned about their reporting?
Absolutely.
Interrogated for hours?
Absolutely, because the questions that they were being asked is, why did you write this? Why did you say this? Do you talk to Hamas people? Of course they talk to Hamas people. It's their job. It's like how you talk to Israeli forces, how you talk to Israeli military personnel or government officials. I mean, that's your job as a journalist. Your job is to talk to people.
And I wanted to ask you, Dalia Hatouka, you're usually based in Amman, Jordan, or in Ramallah in the West Bank, but you're here in the United States now. What's your message to the American public and to the Biden administration, given that this country is the largest supplier of weapons and military aid to Israel?
I think, honestly, the American public has been very instrumental in working with Palestinians. Large segments of the American public have been working with Palestinians. I've seen a lot of support. I've seen a lot of support among Israelis. The few Israelis who get it. I've seen a lot of support among American Jews, and I believe that they are one of the Palestinians' biggest allies. But my message, obviously, to Biden is, there's a lot at stake right now. The Biden administration can do so much, and that's been proven over by the fact that, you know, once Biden put his foot down, several steps were taken by Israel in order to open the border crossings or some of the border crossings into Gaza. But I believe that taking this kind of blind support for Netanyahu is leading us nowhere. And as an American as well, not only as a Palestinian, I have bigger fears of what's to come come November, because if Biden loses the election, and he might because of the situation, because of what's going on in Gaza, then we are doomed, basically, to have another 4 years of a Trump administration. So in my mind, I'm like, you know, we are doomed in the Middle East. We're doomed in the U.S., and I know that's a lot of doom and gloom, but honestly, these are some of the thoughts that people, especially dual nationals like me, these are some of the thoughts that they have.
Dalia Hatuco, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Palestinian independent journalist, usually based between Amman, Jordan, and occupied Ramallah. That's Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Middle East is bracing for possible retaliation from Israel after Iran launched 300 drones and missiles at Israel in response to Israel's recent bombing of the Iranian consulate in Damascus, Syria. The Iranian attack caused little damage inside Israel, which intercepted nearly all the drones and missiles with help from the United States, Britain, France, and Jordan. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for maximum restraint Sunday at an emergency UN Security Council meeting.
The Middle East is on the brink. The people of the region are confronting a real danger of a devastating full-scale conflict. Now is the time to defuse and de-escalate. Now is the time for maximum restraint.
As we broadcast, Israel's war cabinet is reconvening to debate how to respond to Iran's first-ever direct attack. Israeli war cabinet member Benny Gantz has vowed Israel will retaliate against Iran.
In the face of the Iranian threat, we will build a regional coalition and exact the price from Iran in the fashion and timing that is right for us. And most importantly, faced with the desire of our enemies to harm us, we will continue to unite and become stronger.
President Biden's reiterated his, quote, ironclad support for Israel, but he reportedly told Israel's Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, that the United States will not participate in any retaliatory strikes against Iran. At the United Nations Sunday, Iran's UN ambassador, Saeed Erivani, defended the missile and drone attack on Israel, saying it was done in self-defense.
These countries, especially the United States, have shielded Israel from any responsibility for the Gaza massacre, while they have denied Iran inherent right to self-defense against the Israeli armed attack on our diplomatic premises. At the same time, they shamefully justified the Israeli massacre and genocide against the defenseless Palestinian people under the pretext of self-defense.
Iran's attacks on Israel may add new momentum for the U.S. Congress to approve more aid for Israel as the House returns to session today. For more, we go to Tehran, where we're joined by Reza Shea, freelance journalist based in Tehran, where he joins us from. Trita Parsi is executive vice president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, joining us from Washington, D.C. And later, we'll speak with Gideon Levy, award-winning Israeli journalist and author in Tel Aviv. He's columnist for the newspaper Haaretz, a member of its editorial board. His most recent piece is headlined, "If Iran Attacks Israel, the Blame Lies on Israel's Irresponsible Decision-Makers." We welcome you all to Democracy Now! Reza Shea, let's begin with you in Tehran. Can you talk about the response there in Iran's capital after Iran retaliated against Israel for bombing the Iranian consulate in Damascus?
Well, the people of Iran have had a variety of responses and sentiments, and I think it's important to remind everyone that neither myself nor any journalist can sit here and tell you that a population, an entire population, has a single feeling, a single voice, a single sentiment. But this is what you hear oftentimes in Western news media, journalists describing what an entire population is feeling or saying. That's simply not the case. There are different competing sentiments in every population, and that is the case here in Iran. There's a segment of the population here in Iran that are staunch supporters of the clerical establishment, staunch supporters of the supreme leader. They believe that it's the duty of every Muslim to support and help the oppressed, and they view Gazans and Palestinians as the oppressed. They're following very closely the events in Gaza over the past 6 months. They were outraged when Iran's consulate was attacked in Syria, and they cheered Iran's response over the weekend when they fired those rockets and those drones in Israel. That's one segment of the population. There's another segment of the population in Iran that are staunch critics of the government. They have a very different view. They want reform in the government. Some want the government gone. They don't mind when senior officials of the Revolutionary Guard are assassinated. They don't mind when the establishment is undermined, when the Revolutionary Guard is undermined. They believe that the Iranian government, instead of funding Hezbollah and Hamas, should help the people. So they are and they remain critical of Iran's role in this conflict. But it's important to point out that most people here in Iran are remarkably continuing their lives. Obviously, some people are worried. They see the headlines. They wonder what's going to happen. But remarkably, they continue their lives. Schools are open. Stores are open. Businesses are open. And I think that speaks to the resilience of the Iranian people, who face so many challenges over these last 40 plus years, isolation, a horrible economy, inflation, the lack of jobs, but somehow they continue living while monitoring what's happening.
Can you talk about who died in the attack on the Iranian consulate in Damascus? At least two Iranian generals, is that right?
Yeah, these were two Iranian generals that had significant roles in Iran's presence in Syria and the reported operations that Iran has conducted against U.S. targets in the region, in Syria and Iraq. And it's important to note that that many people within the government continue to remind everyone that this was an act of war by Israel, even though Israel has not confirmed that it conducted the attack in the Iranian consulate. Iran continues to remind the international community. They did it at the UN Security Council meeting, that Iran's attack on Israel was a response to an act of war that Israel carried out against an Iranian consulate, which is seen as Iranian soil. It is also important to point out that Iran's response took 2 weeks, and that is in line with how Iran has reacted to similar incidents and assassinations in recent years. You recall the assassination of General Soleimani, the top-ranking Revolutionary Guard general in Iraq in 2020. You'll recall Iran's response was to attack a U.S. airbase in Iraq. But just as they did with this attack in Israel, they took a lot of time. It is reported that they even announced what they were going to do. And that's a clear indication that Iran does not want to escalate matters with Israel and the U.S. And regional allies, that this was, as many say, a performative operation to send a message and calculated in a way where that Iran doesn't want to escalate matters. And you saw Iranian officials explicitly say that for them, the matter is over. Now we wait to see if Israel agrees, if it's over for them, if they retaliate, and what Iran does after that.
I want to go to John Bolton, Trump's former national security advisor, interviewed on CNN.
Give us your assessment of an appropriate Israeli response to what Iran has now done.
Well, what Iran did tonight that I think was most significant was the firing of ballistic missiles and cruise missiles from its territory directly at Israel. Almost certainly at this point, none of those missiles contained a nuclear warhead. But you never can tell when the next firing, the next salvo of ballistic missiles might contain a nuclear warhead. So I think among the many targets Israel should consider, this is the opportunity to destroy Iran's nuclear weapons program. And I hope President Biden is not trying to dissuade Prime Minister Netanyahu from doing that.
So that was John Bolton speaking on CNN. We're also joined by Trita Parsi, Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, speaking to us from Washington, D.C. Trita, can you respond to what Bolton said and also how Washington is responding right now?
Well, I think you saw there in John Bolton's response, he used the word opportunity. And this is how some of the hawks view this. They see this as an opportunity to materialize the war between the United States and Iran and Israel that they have been seeking for more than 25 years. And that includes Bibi Netanyahu. I think it should not be forgotten that Netanyahu has been trying to start a war between the United States and Iran for more than two decades. And it has seen him being actually rebuffed by several presidents in a row who may have been very hawkish in Iran, who may themselves have contemplated the idea of going to war with Iran, but who nevertheless rejected the pressure from Netanyahu to do so on behalf of Israel. But Bolton is reflecting that view, the idea that this is an opportunity to have a much larger war in the Middle East.
And can you talk about President Biden saying that Israel has the ironclad support of the U.S., but telling Netanyahu after this attack that the U.S. would not participate in any kind of retaliation, though the U.S. intercepted, I think they said, how many drones and something like six missiles and 90 drone strikes on with the Iranian attack. Jordan also participated, as did Britain and France.
I think what Biden is saying here is quite contradictory, because at the end of the day, there will be no distinction between offensive and defensive measures in the second the war actually breaks out. So consider this scenario. The United States does not support and does not participate in Israel's counterstrikes against Iran, and the Israelis may follow Bolton's advice and try to target Iran's nuclear facilities. The Iranians then respond in kind with a much larger barrage of missiles. Clearly, what they did this time around was choreographed to minimize damage and make sure that there's no casualties. Next time around, they won't do that. Once the Iranians have started their counterstrikes, then the United States is dragged into the war because Biden said that he will participate in the defensive measures. And then, regardless of what the previous measure was by the United States, the U.S. will be at war in the Middle East. And as a result, Netanyahu now has a clear pathway on how to drag the United States into this war. All he needs to do is to escalate further. The U.S. will reject that, but then the U.S. will be there once the Iranians are responding. And at that point, any distinction between offensive and defensive is meaningless. If Biden instead makes it very, very clear that it does not lie in the U.S.'s interest to have any escalation in the region and draws a red line in front of Iran and in front of Israel, he will then not need to come to the defense of Israel because there will not be a war to begin with. That would be a much better pathway that serves U.S. interests, that prevents any regional escalation. But so far we have seen that Biden, even though he apparently is frustrated privately, he does not feel comfortable to draw any red lines for Israel publicly. And the ones that he has drawn privately, Netanyahu has systematically ignored for the last 7 months.
The Middle East is bracing for Israel to retaliate amidst claims, calls for restraint after Iran fired over 350 drones and missiles at Israel in response to Israel's attack on the Iranian consulate in Syria that killed two Iranian generals and a number of other military officers. We are joined by guests in Tehran and Washington, D.C., and now to Tel Aviv, where we're joined by Gideon Levy, an award-winning Israeli journalist and author, columnist for the newspaper Haaretz, and a member of its editorial board. His most recent piece, headlined, "If Iran Attacks Israel, the Blame Lies on Israel's Irresponsible Decision-Makers." In it, Gideon writes, quote, "For several years now, Israel's provoked Iran constantly in Lebanon, Syria, and also on Iranian soil, and has not paid any price. It would be foolish to believe that the rope Israel has stretched will not break. That moment may have come." He ends by writing, "Just don't say again that there was no choice. There was a choice not to kill. Even if it's deserved, even if it's permitted, and even if it's possible, the person who sent the assassins put Israel at risk of war with Iran." Gideon Levy, you are joined—you are joining Reza Saya, a freelance journalist in Tehran, Iran, and Trita Parsi, one of the heads of the Quincy Institute. Can you respond to Iran's attack and what Israel did to provoke that, the bombing of the Iranian consulate in Damascus? Did that surprise you?
Nothing surprised here. The only thing which surprised, really, was the defensive capability of Israel. Together with its allies, it was really impressive, but it's not a guarantee for the future. When I wrote my article, it was before the attack came, and still I thought that the assassination in Damascus was unnecessary. The problem with the Israeli armed forces and intelligence organizations is that whenever they see an opportunity, they take it without thinking about the consequences, without thinking about the price. And until now, it was working for them because Iran didn't react until now directly on Israel, only through its proxy. But it was very clear that this cannot last forever. So those who send the assassinators to assassinate on Iranian soil, on an Iranian diplomatic mission, those two generals and five more, those had to think what will be the next day. And the next day came, and we were attacked. And luckily enough, we didn't suffer out of this attack. The only conclusion right now should be, no, don't you dare to retaliate now, because then we will be in a regional war, and that's a new game.
Talk about what Benny Gantz said. As we broadcast right now, the war cabinet, Israel's war cabinet, has reconvened. What Netanyahu said, of course, they are competing with each other. If Netanyahu were to go down, it's conceivable Benny Gantz would become the next prime minister. But talk about what's happening within that war cabinet. Benny Gantz.
Amy, it's for a long time that I claim that those who want to get rid of Netanyahu are obviously right, but the hope that the alternative will be any better on core issues. On many issues, it will be much better. But on core issues like apartheid, occupation, continuing the war in Gaza, will be very, very disappointed. And here we go. Benny Gantz, who is the alternative, who is the liberal alternative, who is the dovish alternative of Israel, he speaks exactly like Netanyahu and would act exactly like Netanyahu when it comes to core issues, to core questions like launching an assassination, like launching a war, like using the military power of Israel. And that's really very, very depressing, that there is no alternative thinking in Israel and no lessons out of the experience. All the assassinations that Israel committed, all of them, never led to anywhere. Nothing good came out of them, except of the ego of the organizations who stood behind it. And here comes this Benny Gantz, the big hope of the liberal Israel, and suggests to continue the war, to make it worse, to go for a regional war with Iran. That's really, really very depressing.
Are you concerned, Gideon Levy, that what's happening with Iran now is taking attention away from what's happening in Gaza, where the death toll just continues to mount, over close to 34,000 people? Just the official death toll is expected to be much higher, and where the resistance was mounting in the United States, for example, on President Biden not to arm Israel, given what's happening in Gaza, now the House, which is notoriously divided, is perhaps coming together around giving more aid to Israel.
It goes without saying, Amy, not only Gaza is forgotten. Also, look what is happening in the West. Pogrom after pogrom, and nobody cares anymore. The army collaborates in those pogroms. We have videos from the last days in which the army not only stands aside, but many times take part of those pogroms against the Palestinians, and nobody pays attention to it. Not to speak, obviously, about Gaza, because everyone is now concerned about Iran. But Gaza is still starving and bleeding, and we shouldn't forget it, even not for a moment, like we shouldn't forget the hostages who are still there. But it seems that now everyone is only concerned about retaliating Iran. This would be such a major, maybe fatal mistake.
I wanted to bring back in Reza Sayah. You were based in Cairo, Egypt, when you covered the negotiations between Israel and Hamas in 2014, as Israel launched its assault on Gaza then. Can you talk about what unfolded back then and how it compares to the negotiations that are taking place, what, in Doha and Cairo now for a ceasefire?
Well, obviously, back then, what took place, as is taking place right now on a smaller scale, was the killing of lots of innocent civilians. But one thing that sticks out in my mind in 2014 in covering that conflict was the Israeli government's flat-out refusal to negotiate. There were so many instances when I was talking to Hamas leaders who were in Cairo. And in these instances, they would tell me that the Israeli officials who were supposed to show up, you know, for those negotiations simply would not show up. And this was something that was not widely reported by Western U.S. media. The Israeli government's seeming unwillingness to negotiate with Hamas. Eventually, there was negotiations, and that war ended. But in subsequent years leading up to this conflict, the cycle of war continued. But that's something that sticks out in my mind in that 2014 conflict.
I wanted to ask about Jordan's position in all of this, Trita Parsi, what role it plays. You had the United States, Britain, Jordan, France, all intercepting some of these drones and missiles.
Yes, numerous countries participated in the interception of these missiles, and the only reason they could do so was because the Iranians had given them 72 hours heads up deliberately, because the entire purpose of this exercise was not to inflict damage, but to restore what the Iranians believe is their deterrence and showcase their capability. And as Gideon said, the shooting down of these missiles were quite impressive. But I think we also have to keep in mind that there might be a different scenario in the future in which there is no forewarning of these attacks. And as a result, France, Britain, and the United States will not be able to prepare for and participate in this extent in the shooting down of the missile. And then, as a result, it's not entirely clear to what extent the Israeli air defenses would be capable of handling what would likely be a much larger barrage of missiles shot at Israel. So I think the Israelis may have also picked up that at the end of the day, a military confrontation, even though Israel, of course, is much stronger in Iran and certainly the U.S. is, but nevertheless will be very, very damaging to Israel as well. And that, I think, is one of the key messages the Iranians were trying to send. The Jordanians are, of course, caught in the middle there because all of these different things are then flying over Jordanian airspace. And the Jordanian position has been that they're defending their airspace. They're not defending Israel. This is not done in order to necessarily help the Israelis. It's to make sure that Jordan asserts that no war should be taking place on its territory or in its airspace. That, nevertheless, is a tough position for the Jordanians to take, given the very, very strong sentiments that are now boiling over inside of Jordan because of the population's frustration with what is happening in Gaza and their perception that the Jordanian government and the Arab world at large have been helpless and not done enough to prevent this lot.
I wanted to ask Gideon Levy if you've been surprised by the amount of conversation going on between Iran and the United States, perhaps not directly. And also, I want to put that question to Reza Sayah, but where the result is you have the United States saying they will not participate in Israel's retaliation if they retaliate against Iran?
First of all, I would say we always portray Iran as a crazy state, as an insane state, and it might be described like this. But in this case, it was very measured, very measured. I wish the United States and Iran would have spoken much more. I wish the agreement, the nuclear agreement, would be still valid, and we would be in a much better place and safer place rather than what both Donald Trump and Netanyahu arranged us, canceling this agreement, which was the best way to prevent Iran from getting nuclear weapons. The more they speak, the better. Under the table, above the table, behind the curtains, any way to talk to them. I still believe that every regime has its own interest, and dialogue is, by the end of the day, the best way, even if it's the Satan of Iran.
Several Google employees, at least nine, were arrested Tuesday evening after staging sit-ins at the company's offices in New York and in California to protest the tech giant's work with the Israeli government. The sit-ins, organized by the activist group No Tech for Apartheid, took place at Google Cloud CEO Thomas Kurian's office in Sunnyvale, California, and the 10th-floor commons of Google's New York office, which is right around the corner from Democracy Now! Protesters are calling for Google to withdraw from a $1.2 billion contract to provide cloud computing services to the Israeli government, known as Project Nimbus. Last week, Time magazine reported Google's work on the project involves providing direct services to the Israeli military. The sit-ins were accompanied by outdoor protests at the Google offices here in New York and in Sunnyvale, San Francisco, and Seattle, Washington. Workers and outside activists have opposed the contract since it was signed in 2021, but protests have ramped up over the past several months since Israel's latest bombardment of Gaza. No Tech for Apartheid says Google is enabling and profiting from Israel's use of artificial intelligence to develop a kill list to target Palestinians in Gaza for assassination with little human oversight. The Israeli military is also using Google Photos for facial recognition across Gaza and the West Bank to identify and detain Palestinians en masse. No Tech for Apartheid has published an open letter co-signed by 18 other groups that demands Google and Amazon immediately cancel their work on Project Nimbus. The letters gathered more than 94,000 signatures from the general public. For more, we're joined by two of the arrested Google workers. Ray Westrick is with us. She's a Google worker organizer with No Tech for Apartheid campaign. Among the workers who occupied Google Cloud CEO's Thomas Kurian's office in Sunnyvale, California. She's joining us from Sunnyvale. And here in New York, we're joined by Mohamed Khatami, a Google software engineer who was arrested at the sit-in at Google's office in New York. He's joining us along with Gabriel Schuvener, a former software engineer at Google Research and organizer with the No Tech for Apartheid campaign. And before that, he was with Jewish Diaspora and Tech. We welcome you all to Democracy Now! Mohammed, let's begin with you. You were just hours ago in the jail in the local police precinct. Talk about why you were willing to get arrested.
Well, rather than, you know, consider the demands that we've been raising for, you know, years now, and, you know, listening to workers and considering the things that we've been raising, Thomas Kurian and Google execs basically chose to arrest workers for speaking out against the use of our technology to power the first AI-powered genocide. So we were willing to get arrested for that because, at this point, we aren't willing to be lied to by our higher-ups anymore. We aren't willing to be disrespected by our higher-ups anymore. And we wanted to take that to the offices and make sure it was understood by them. Yeah.
How do you sense is the support that you have among other Google workers, the degree of the dissatisfaction with the policies of Google?
Yeah. I mean, Google has done a really good job at creating a culture of fear and retaliation against workers in general. But what we noticed was beautiful. So many people came up to our sit-in and basically showed support and felt that they were inspired by the work that we were doing and felt inspired to speak out, which is exactly what we were going for. We want workers to feel like we have the power to choose where our technology is going and who we're contributing to. So I felt really happy to see that. Yeah.
Ray Westrick, you're on the West Coast. You were arrested in California. Talk about this Project Nimbus and why you were willing to get arrested and what the response—were you in the offices of the Google Cloud CEO?
Yes. We sat in at the office of Thomas Kurian, the Google Cloud CEO, to protest Project Nimbus, which is a $1.2 billion contract with the Israeli government and military between Google and Amazon. We also were demanding the protection of our coworkers, especially our Palestinian, Arab, and Muslim coworkers, who have been consistently retaliated against, harassed, and doxed for speaking out about Project Nimbus and, you know, the humanity of Palestinians. So we were there in solidarity with them. We were there to protest the contract, which is being directly sold, providing technology directly to the Israeli military as it inflicts a genocide on Palestinians in Gaza. And yeah, that is why we chose to sit in Thomas Kurian's office.
And Ray, was there any response from the CEO or his office? And are you concerned about losing your job? Why did you decide to take this action?
Yeah, we did not receive any response from the CEO, and I think it's really telling that they would rather let us sit there for over 10 hours and arrest us for peacefully sitting in his office than have leadership engage in our demands in any way at all. So we've received no response from the CEO, and we were forcibly removed by the police. And working at Google has been, you know, an honor. I really love my team. I love the work I do, but I can't in good conscience not do anything while Google is a part of this contract, while Google is selling technology to the Israeli military or any military. And so it was a risk I was willing to take, and I think it's a risk a lot of my coworkers are willing to take because a lot of people are really agitated about this and have consistently made their demands clear and have faced retaliation for it. So I chose to sit in knowing the risks out of care for the use of our technology, out of care for the impact of our technology, and care for my coworkers.
For our radio audience, I wanted to let people know that Ray is wearing a T-shirt that says Googler Against Genocide with Genocide and the famous multicolor of Google that it's so well known for. I wanted to bring Gabriel Schuvener into this conversation, a former software engineer at Google Research and organizer with the No Tech for Apartheid campaign. and ask you, you know, we had you on more than a year ago. This is before Israel's latest attack on Gaza, talking about exactly this. And you were with the Jewish organization of Google workers at that time speaking out. Talk about the whole history of Project Nimbus.
Yeah.
And the resistance against it.
Yeah, thank you so much. So Project Nimbus was signed in May of 2021. While bombs were being dropped on Gaza, while Palestinians were being evicted from Sheikh Jarrah and beaten at Al-Aqsa Mosque, that was really a point when we found out about Project Nimbus. Personally, for me, it was a turning point where I no longer felt able to continue doing my work without engaging and organizing. There was a group of people that felt very similarly, so we started a petition. We were connected, got connected with Amazon workers, with community organizations, at Jewish Voice for Peace and Empower Change, and spun a campaign out of that. I want to be clear, like, the campaign really is driven by worker concerns and worker needs around the ethical use of our labor, as well as the direct workplace concerns of the health and safety concerns around working at a company that is facilitating genocide. We've known for a long time that this project was directly targeted at the military. It's been reported in press that Google was giving trainings directly to the IOF. We know that Google gave trainings directly to Mossad. We know that the IOF
When you say IOF, explain the term. Because people are used to hearing IDF, Israeli Defense Forces.
Yeah, it's Israeli Occupation Forces, just to indicate, so we're not repeating their messaging, that their really aggressive repression of Palestinians is an act of defense. We know that it's an act of occupation, so we say IOF. So we've known for a long time that this project was directly targeted at the Israeli military, but it was only recently, through this last contract that Google signed directly with the IOF, that we recognized that Google is really doubling down, that this contract is directly intended to facilitate military use. And we know that Google was chosen over other companies because of the advanced AI technology that they are able to offer. So given that we've learned how the IOF is using AI in this war, we really see this as a really critical campaign for Palestinian liberation. To speak to your point about the resistance against the project, we've been working against this project as workers for since it was signed 3 years ago. We have been doing organizing. We have been doing base building and labor organizing. We've had protests externally and internally. We've had signed petitions. We've done outreach to our executives through internal forums, through chat rooms, through every available means. Because I think, understanding this contract really is it really is an incredible issue for our work. All workers labor at Google. So many workers labor is contributing directly to this project because all of the technology at Google is deeply intertwined with each other. So.
Okay.
See it's really important.
I wanted to ask you, the average person who's not a Google worker who might support your stand who uses Google multiple times a day around the world, what are you calling for them to do?
Right. So, we're calling for everyone around the world to really help us with awareness, help us make it known that Google is a war profiteer. I think Google is so deeply embedded in people's lives, right, that it's hard to ask for a boycott, but I think we are calling specifically on people in the tech industry to divest from Google and Amazon. Google Cloud Services and Amazon Web Services underlie the vast majority of the internet. But there are other options. So technology workers actually have a lot of power to shift this paradigm and to remove technology from this deep complicity with the Israeli occupation.
Mohammed Khatami, can you talk about your own family background and why you so particularly care right now about what's going on in Gaza?
Yes. So I come from a Muslim family. I was raised Muslim. It's really hard to wake up seeing the images of children slaughtered and know that you're, the work you're doing is contributing to this. I've lost sleep. It's just been extremely difficult to focus on work and think that you're working for something that is contributing to the mass slaughter that's taking place. And for speaking out against that, I've literally been called a supporter of terrorism, which is something that
called by,
you know, by coworkers and HR and people in the company, supporter of terrorism, which is, you know, something is, it's like a schoolyard insult. It's something I haven't heard since middle school. And that's just an example of the retaliation and the harassment and the hatred that we face just for speaking up against our work being used in this way.
Are you concerned about losing your job?
Absolutely, but it doesn't. It's not even important to me at all compared to working for something that is meaningful and having a good impact on the planet. I don't want to have any association with this genocide, and I would hope that Google would change their mind about it as well. Yeah.
And finally, Ray Westrick, where do you see this movement going from here? And can you talk more about the Jewish-Muslim alliance around this among Google workers and former Google workers?
Yeah. I only see this movement growing and continuing to apply pressure. We receive so much support during the sit-in. I've received so many personal messages from people, you know, thanking me for being vocal and asking how they can be more vocal and get more involved. So I think this is absolutely growing. I think Google knows that that this will continue, that, you know, workers are very agitated about this and will continue to speak up and apply pressure. And I think that's why it was important for them to silence us. But this movement is growing, and more people are finding out about this, and more people are willing to organize and risk their jobs in order to take a stand against complicity and genocide.
Well, I want to thank.
And yeah, I think this has been a really unifying campaign for people of all backgrounds. And I know specifically a lot of us came together because we were specifically concerned about how Google has treated and retaliated against our Palestinian, Arab, and Muslim colleagues, especially like Mohammed mentioned. A lot of them have experienced harassment and doxing for speaking out in, like, the appropriate channels at Google, and have been consistently ignored and harassed and retaliated against. And so we had to come together to say that we can't let this happen anymore. We have to come together in protection of our coworkers and each other, and in protection of, you know, the ethical use of our technology to make sure that we're not building technology that's being used for harm. So I think it's been a really unifying campaign that is really grounded in taking care of each other and really grounded in making a positive impact and not facilitating more harm with technology.
I want to thank you all for being with us. Ray Westrick and Mohammed Khatami are both Google workers who were arrested yesterday. Ray in the offices of the Google Cloud CEO in Sunnyvale, California, and Mohammed here in New York. Also, Gabriel Schubiner, former software engineer at Google Research and an organizer with the No Tech for Apartheid campaign, before that with Jewish Diaspora in Tech.
That's it for us for today. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
You're listening to CKUT. The following is a previously broadcast program. Stay tuned.
We argue in the kitchen about whether to have children, about the world ending in the scale of my ambition, and how much is art really worth. The very thing you're best at is the thing that hurts the most. But you need your rotten heart, your dazzling pain like diamond rings. You need to go to war to find material to sing. I am a mother, I'm a bride.